Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Answers from the Lab, where we share Mayo Clinic knowledge and advancements on the state of testing and science from laboratory leaders and the people who are making it happen behind the scenes. I'm Dr. Bobby Pritt, Chair of the Division of Clinical Microbiology at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. With us today is one of our frequent guests, Dr. Ellie Thiel, who is the Laboratory Director of the Infectious Diseases Serology Laboratory here at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And my colleague, Ellie, it's so great to have you back here with us today.
Thanks, Bobby. Glad to be here, as always.
And we get to talk about syphilis again. We just talked about syphilis recently with the rise in congenital rates, but now we have a new publication by the CDC that I think is worth talking about.
Yes. So the CDC just came out with kind of a refreshed version of their testing guidelines for syphilis. So they have some interesting statistics and a nice summary of the performance characteristics data for all of the tests we have available for syphilis.
Yeah, let's talk about that because I think it'll be of interest to our group. We will include a link for those that want to read this for themselves, published in the MMWR. I thought it was a very nice review of the history of syphilis. Of course, it's a disease of antiquity. It's been with us for a long time, the different causes of syphilis. So maybe you could start by just reminding the audience what syphilis is.
Yeah, so syphilis is a spirochete. The one that we think of most frequently in the U.S. is caused by Treponema pallidum, subspecies pallidum. So that's kind of your classic cause of syphilis. But there's two other less common subspecies of syphilis, but they do cause disease. So there's Treponema pallidum, subspecies peritoneum. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But that one's found more in tropical areas of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and that one causes a disease referred to as yaws. And then there's Treponema pallidum subspecies endemicum, which is cause of endemic syphilis or Bagel. And that's mostly occurs in children, and it's found in kind of the Eastern Mediterranean, Western Africa, and Cuba. So there's these other kind of subspecies of syphilis. We don't really hear about them too often because we mostly focus on Treponema pallidum, subspecies pallidum. And this spirochete, syphilis can really progress through multiple different stages of infection. The kind of primary stage of syphilis is classically characterized by the formation of what's called a chancre. It's this kind of beefy lesion, and it's notably painless, unlike some of the other sexually transmitted infections. This is a painless lesion, so it can be missed when it's found, like in the oral mucosa or in the genital tract. It's not maybe as commonly observed. And that lesion can go away by its own, on its own, without treatment. And patients can then progress to secondary syphilis, which is classically characterized with a kind of a maculopapular rash on the torso, but also classically on the palms and soles of the hands and the feet. That too can kind of dissipate and disappear on its own without treatment. And then patients enter kind of this latent stage of infection where they're essentially asymptomatic. And then over time, which can be years to decades after that, they can progress to tertiary syphilis, which has a number of kind of more severe consequences in manifestations. And any of these stages, patients can also develop neuroinvasive syphilis or neurosyphilis kind of any time after that primary infection. So syphilis is one of those diseases that I think Sir William Osler referred to it as the physician who knows syphilis knows medicine.
Yeah.
present in such a variety of different ways.
Yes, I've also heard it called the great imitator, syphilis, as this disease that can mimic so many other things. And I think I mentioned previously when we spoke last that it also has a lot of dermatologic manifestations, like you just mentioned, maculopapular rash or that primary chancre. And so the field of dermatology used to be the field of dermatology and syphilology. And their first journal used to be the Journal of Dermatology and Syphilology, which I think is fascinating. Now we can kind kind of put syphilis in its own category, and it goes more over into primary care and infectious diseases, but still a terrible disease that's with us today. And in fact, we think it might be getting more common. Can you tell us a little bit about what we're seeing in the U.S. and worldwide?
Yeah, so we are actually in a syphilis epidemic currently. So the number, the cases of syphilis have been rising pretty dramatically over the last 5 to 10 years. So the most recent data from the CDC, and this was published in the MMWR that we're talking about, showed that we have approximately 176,000 cases of syphilis that were reported to the CDC in 2021. And we have approximately 6 million new cases occurring worldwide. So this is an ancient disease, but it is still happily replicating and occurring today. And so if we talk about increases, so just looking at the numbers here, there was an increase from 5,979 cases reported in 2000 to 133,945 cases reported in 2020, which represents 2,000% increase in primary and secondary cases of
That's terrible too, because those manifestations you just described are horrible. The primary disease may not sound like much, but the fact that it never really goes away and then can come back as secondary or tertiary syphilis, and that used to be a big cause of death. I've seen it on our old autopsy reports from the early 1900s. Syphilis was one of the primary causes of death from death in individuals at that time.
Yeah. It's really unfortunate. The epidemic is really primarily occurring in amongst populations where we see a lot of health disparity, especially amongst sexual and gender minority populations. Individuals with HIV, those with substance abuse are, you know, largely our populations that are being hit with higher rates of syphilis right now.
Yeah. So the laboratory plays an important role in diagnosing syphilis. Can you give us just an overview of what are the different types of tests that we offer for diagnosing syphilis?
So classically, we refer to our syphilis tests as treponemal tests, meaning those that detect specific antibodies to the organism itself. And then the second class are non-treponemal tests, which are really detecting antibodies to various different lipid substances, cardiolipin, lecithin, which is a phosphorylcholine component of cell membranes. So those are kind of your two groups. One of the biggest changes or updates that came out of this CDC MMWR publication is actually their recommendation to now refer to the non-treponemal tests as lipoidal tests. Mm. The reason being, you know, classically we talk about antibodies to cardiolipin, which are thought to be just molecules that are released from damaged host cells. Well, as it turns out, cardiolipin, lecithin, these are also found in the cell membrane of Treponema pallidum as well. So the antibodies that we're detecting aren't just non-treponemal. They're also detecting cardiolipin and lecithin from the Treponema pallidum cell membrane as well. So we can't call them non-treponemal. So the recommendation is to refer to these as lipoidal antibodies now.
Yeah, that is interesting. I read that with interest as well, that the treponemes themselves have these lipids, lipoid structures that are being detected. So you can't really say non-treponemal, but you don't want to call them all treponemal. So, okay, we have lipoidal versus treponemal.
Yes.
Is that still the two categories then? Yeah.
Correct.
Even though the lipoidal could also be treponemal.
Yeah, so we're detecting the lipoidal antibodies. You're detecting, you know, they're detecting antibodies that are against released lipid components of the host cell membrane, but also the treponemal cell membrane. So they are, you know, as one would suggest, they are not specific to Treponema pallidum. So that's
that makes sense.
There.
Versus the other type of antibodies, which truly are against the treponemes themselves, Treponema pallidum.
Correct. Yep. So those are the two tests that we use. They're still recommended to be used in combination in the new or in the refreshed, I should say, guidelines. And, you know, without going through all of the details, I think the key is that for regular syphilis, when you want to, you know, detect infection, you have the option of using either the traditional syphilis testing algorithm or the reverse screening algorithm for syphilis. The traditional classically starts with the lipoidal or non-treponemal test. If that's reactive, you want to confirm it with a treponemal, a specific antibody test. The reason being that these non-treponemal lipoidal antibodies, as we talked about, are non-specific. They can be caused by other infections. There can also be just biologic false positive results with those antibody tests. And so if you have a positive, you want to confirm it with a treponemal antibody test. And so if both of those are positive in the traditional algorithm, the patient would be diagnosed with syphilis. In the reverse screening algorithm, it's flip-flopped. You start with a treponemal antibody test. If that is positive, you want to reflex it to a lipoidal non-treponemal test. One to confirm the infection, but more also to get a titer, because our lipoidal tests give us semi-quantitative titers, which are useful to monitor response to treatment, amongst other things. The challenge comes in when your treponemal antibody test is reactive, your non-treponemal or lipoidal antibody test is non-reactive. So now you have two discordant or you have discordant results. In those cases, the recommendation is to perform a second different treponemal test. The reference standard right now for that is the treponema pallidum particle agglutination test, or the TPPA test. And that will kind of help determine whether that initial screening test was a true positive or a false positive, and help you stage the disease state, so where we are in syphilis. So they're complicated.
Well, that's why we have experts like you, which is helpful. And
yes.
I would assume that if the treponemal tests were positive, but the non-treponemal or lipoidal test is negative and you confirm it truly is positive, that could have been past disease.
Exactly. So there's two possible scenarios: past treated infection or past untreated infection, because patients that have progressed into latent or tertiary infection, those lipoidal antibody tests are not as sensitive. So that's one option. The other option is very early infection, when our RPRs, VDRLs are actually not as sensitive as our treponemal tests. So in those cases, it's really important to get a good clinical history, a good past treatment history, exposure history, to best stage the patient's disease course.
Yes, that was another thing I liked with this MMWR article, is that it showed the timeline when the treponemal and the non-treponemal lipoidal tests become positive. And it looks like there's a 2-week window where the treponemal antibodies will be positive prior to the lipoidal.
Correct. Yes.
So they're more sensitive early on.
They are more sensitive. And so that's one of the key benefits of using the reverse screening algorithm, is that you will potentially be catching a higher number of cases earlier than if you were using the traditional testing algorithm. So to your point, you know, with some laboratories like ours, we offer both algorithms. We allow the clinicians to choose which algorithm they'd like to use. But other laboratories might not have that ability to maintain two different algorithms. And so there's a couple of things to think about. And I think the MMWR really nicely summarizes advantages and limitations of the algorithms. So the traditional algorithm, I'll just say, is really, it's a little bit less expensive, because you're starting with a pretty cheap lipoidal screening antigen test. It's good in regions where you have a high rate of syphilis, and then if your volume is low, because the RPRs, the VDRLs, your lipoidal antigen tests are pretty manual. They're almost entirely manual. There are some assays or some instruments that have automated RPR testing, but you know, they're not widely used, at least to my knowledge, as of yet. Whereas the reverse testing algorithm starts with a highly automated platform, so you have high volume throughput, and is good for reference laboratories or laboratories that do a lot of testing. So you omit that that manual step. So
yeah,
there's
it's definitely
complicated, other
like you
too.
Said.
Yes.
Yes. I'm glad that you have all this information about the tests on our Mayo Clinic Laboratories website.
We do.
Which is great. And you've done a lot of education on this because it is such an important issue, especially since we are in a syphilis epidemic, as you said, which is worrisome. Now, the MMWR had a few other recommendations. I was interested to see that they said for people that are living with HIV, pregnant women, it doesn't matter. You should still do the same algorithm, the standard of care, which is the serologic testing. And did I interpret that correctly?
You did, yes. So they recommend testing with either one of the algorithms, but it should be done. The other key point that I think the MMWR hammered home was that if you are treating patients and if you are monitoring titers, you need to be using the same test. The same test, either RPR or VDRL in some cases, performed ideally in the same laboratory. Because these tests are manual, they are subjective to read. And so there's that level of acceptable subjectivity, but it's minimized if you perform, if you monitor titers by the same test from performed at the same lab. So I was,
that makes sense.
I like that they really underscored the importance of that.
Yeah, that is very nice. I like that recommendation. And then as a pathologist, I was interested to see that they also had the recommendation that if you are looking at tissue sections in formalin fixed paraffin embedded tissue, that you should use the specific or somewhat specific immunohistochemical tests that are designed to detect treponema pallidum, although they also detect a few other spirochetes, but that you should use these immunohistochemical tests instead of the old silver deposition methods or impregnation methods like the Worth and Starry and the Steiner stain. I was very happy to see that because these silver impregnation methods are very difficult to read. They can be very dark with a lot of artifact. I, from my own experience, have noted that the immunohistochemical methods are much more sensitive in detecting spirochetes.
Yes.
Yeah, so I was pleased to see that.
They did spend some time outlining the advantages and limitations of those. I thought that was very nice as well. Yes.
Yeah, every once in a while, an infectious disease physician asks me to do a Worth and Starry stain, and I'm like, oh, no. We have better methods these days.
We do.
So, yeah, I really enjoyed reading this. So I'm glad that we were able to really touch on some of the high points. I would encourage others to read it if they're interested in this topic.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you have any last thoughts on this topic for everyone?
Yeah, I'll just say the other classic test, the dark field microscopy test for syphilis, you know, not a lot of places do this anymore, but they did spend some time talking about this in the guidelines. And their recommendation was, you know, if you are doing this, to continue doing it, but it's really primarily useful in STD clinics for direct detection at the point of care, where syphilis rates are highly endemic and there's a good level of training and understanding how to read these because they are very subjective. They can be difficult to interpret. So not a lot of places do them, but they're still used in some STD clinics in highly endemic areas. So I thought that was interesting as well.
I thought that was interesting as well. And it's probably good to mention that that is considered a moderate complexity test and it falls under PPM, provider or physician provided microscopy, something like that. Regardless, there are some recommendations and some requirements if you're going to be performing that type of test.
That's right.
For those who can do it and do it well, it's a nice quick way to see spirochetes from that primary lesion. Well, Dr. Thiel, this has been a really interesting topic. I definitely learned a lot talking with you and reading this article. So thank you for joining us today again to talk about syphilis, an important topic today.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Pritt.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Answers from the Lab. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast and don't forget to tune in every Thursday and every other Tuesday.